And greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. It is a Monday, an unusual day for The Dividing Line. The plan is to go fairly long today. Got a lot to talk about. However, I'm just letting you know right now, this is my phone. Yes, it is a nice phone. I gave in after years of being a Droid guy. I have an iPhone 6S. It's quite a piece of equipment. Love it. It is on, and the ringer is on, and it's going to stay on. Because, in fact, you'll probably hear it making little noises during the course of the program today. Because that's what it does. Very frequently. And I will look at it. And I normally don't do that during the program. But the reality is that my daughter is pregnant and is due on Thursday. And as you may know, when you're that close, 3 days, I could get a phone call. And if I get a phone call, instead of being a jumbo or a mega dividing line, this could be a mini dividing line. So I'm just letting you know, right up, doesn't matter what we're talking about, we could be right in the middle of the most interesting video on the planet, unless Rich wants to take over and review Bart Ehrman or whatever, then it's just the way it is. So just so you know, you will be hearing little noises. I haven't forgotten it. It's purposeful. But that's just the way that it is. So, letting you know right up front. Don't text message doc, not summer. I don't understand that. But anyway, so there you go. All right. Got a lot to get to today. See, there was a ding right there. And that, of course, was Red in Channel, who just wants, you know, that's his way of turning the lights off or, you know, doing whatever else, you know, people like him do. Anything to interrupt what is important that's going on is what Alan, that's his real name. You know, that guy calls from Georgia? Yeah, that's the same guy. It's just one of those, you know, people that, you know, during this life, in this world, we just have to put up with them because sanctification is not complete in this life, and someday, so, here it starts, I should have let that go. All right, anyway, let's start by offending lots of folks. Why not? I have a feeling we're going to be doing that a lot anyways. Saw a movie last week. I've been asked what I thought about it. And I'm going to play a portion of the trailer for the movie. And then I'll give you my very honest thoughts on the film. And some of you will like that, and some of you will not. And that's just the way it goes. So you ready in there with the super-duper... thingy here. Let's see how it works.
Well, Doug's got to be brave to go into that kind of thing.
Just so you know, there's nothing wrong with your screen. It's just the methodology of this particular film and others like it, is sort of like lens flares in Star Trek, okay? It's all jumpy, cut everywhere type, you know, black and white this. Really artsy, okay? For people my age, not the best, but just so you know, you don't have to jump up and adjust your rabbit ears. Of course, you don't know what rabbit ears are. Anyways.
As a gay instructor, as an atheist...
I mean, I don't think we ever had a security plan for Doug before. It's an assertion by Rob Hauer
by claiming victimhood.
Rebellion.
Charges, you're a racist.
Racist, sexist, and again.
You're a sexist.
It's all insulting, go away.
And you're anti-gay. Racist, sexist, anti-gay, Douglas Wilson, go away.
Right. And it's stated in such a way as to rhyme.
Okay, I was going to stop before then. Sorry about that. I didn't realize it had been going that long. There was a fair amount of profanity in the film. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. As long as it was the protesters doing their thing, and I didn't have any problem with it, there was a point, however, where I think that it was a rap song. I generally can't understand what's being said in most rap songs, honestly. But it seemed to me that there was one time where it was just Doug Wilson's face with a rap song in the background that was dropping a lot of profanity. I could be wrong because sometimes I can't understand what's being said. But anyway, the free speech apocalypse, I saw it Thursday night and appreciated the invitation to go do that and saw it with some cool folks. Let's start off with the positives and then go to the negatives. Some of you will remember that when Douglas Wilson went and did that presentation, we played a bunch of this stuff. Remember the young girl? Her dad standing there, the 13-year-old girl, and the exchange that he had with her, and we played that and went through it and provided further response to it and... and they went through a lot. They played a lot of that material in the beginning of the film. The first, 35-40% of the film was pretty much about that particular encounter. How it came about. There was some footage I had not seen about what was going on outside. One of the things that was fascinating was that many of these people showed up with makeup on to make them look like they had been abused and beaten. One thing that certainly was made very, very clear to me is these people know how to project the image of victimhood when they're not the victims. They use it as a means of power and to silence others. No question about it. That was definitely something to be reminded of. Is their constant drumbeat of victimhood, victimhood, victimhood. You see it all the time. And it's gotten so bad that if anything doesn't go the way of the homosexual cabal, the first thing you hear is, you will have blood on your hands because of the young people who will commit suicide as a result. Never even thinking that that might say something about homosexuality. Not about me, but about homosexuality. That might mean there's something fundamentally wrong with the concept of homosexuality and the practice of homosexuality. I mean, doesn't suggest itself because we are the victims and you will celebrate us and our sexuality. So that was very good. And I said back when this took place, what was it, 2013-ish, somewhere around there? It wasn't that long ago, but it was about 2013, I think. I said at the time, I said, man, hats off to Doug Wilson for going in there, for keeping us cool, keeping calm. you know, there are not too many people that can do that. I've been in similar situations, not quite that nasty in that sense, but, you know, it's, I understand the pressures that were there, and he did a good job. Certainly there was a lot of, there's every reason to be talking about the fact that the homosexual totalitarians are in control. A couple days ago, Adam 4D, the Christian comic writer, does a great job, had a comic pulled from Facebook where he gave three examples of real bigoted, biased, anti-homosexual attitudes. And then the fourth part of his panel, he had the Christians saying, I believe this is against God's law and that it's sinful behavior, and it was called not homophobia. They pulled it. It was clearly making the distinction. Pulled it. You can't. The totalitarians don't care about fairness, truth, accuracy, honesty, integrity. These are words that have no meaning in the totalitarian universe. In their universe, if it does not lead to the celebration, the universal celebration of homosexuality, then it's bad. Even if it's just tolerance. Tolerance is not good enough. Tolerance, that's old. That's passé. Tolerance isn't good enough. It must be celebration. You must say this is good, this is right, this is great, this is wonderful. I celebrate you, 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 you. Because that's what it's all about, is you, 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 you. And so there's much to be said about the fact that our university campuses are no longer places of free speech. The thought police have taken over every university campus in America, with the small exception of a few little places. And have we thought through what that means as far as education is concerned? Have we thought through what it means that these young people who cannot think critically, have never been taught to think, have been taught that thinking critically is a bad thing, have been taught that their brainwashed way of thinking is actually thinking critically. That's self-deception. It's amazing. That these people will be in charge in a matter of years. And hence, when we see the government doing insane things, and we go, well, it can't keep going because that's insane. No, it can keep going. Because insanity requires some kind of standard by which you can recognize that it's insanity. And that standard is disappearing. So there's much to be said about the subject of free speech. Unfortunately, only about 40% of the film was on that subject. Then it just spun off into a bunch of other stuff that's interesting. I mean, there is a big, long discussion about Lincoln, slavery, an appropriate discussion of how the what's called the Civil War, the war between the states, direct historical line from that to the overarching federal power of the government today. No question about it. That's where states' rights disappeared. That's where any of the controls that were originally intended to be a part of the constitutional system on a abusive, overarching federal bureaucracy, that's where that all fell apart. There's no question about that. There really wasn't a good connection made to help you understand why all of a sudden we're talking about this, but... And at that point, it just started trying to talk about everything under the sun. And let's negatives. Artsy, 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 way too artsy. I don't like artsy. Okay? Way too much Doug Wilson time. I'm sorry. Doug Wilson says many great things. But I think if the producer could have done it, he would have stuck a camera up his nose to get that angle. You've got angles from up above. You've got angles from down below. You've got all this artsy, artsy, artsy stuff that just... I'm just like, really? Seriously? I mean, after a while, it's, you know what it is? It's like back when I discovered all the cool stuff you could do with PowerPoint, you know? I mean, you can make your text bounce in from over here, and then it can bounce in from over there, and it can spin, and I had all these presentations for a while where it just, you know, almost give you vertigo because of all the stuff you can do. And then we got past that and realized, you don't want to do a whole lot of that. You know, once in a while, if you want to emphasize something, maybe, you know, but, yeah. So, artsy. Way too artsy. Too much Doug. Way too much close-ups of Doug. I mean, seriously, it was a big screen. You know, I was just, this type of, that's why I say, you know, if it could have gone up the nostrils, you could have, would have. The film was minimally half an hour too long. Maybe 45 minutes too long. Just too long. The first part moved along fairly well, and then it just started slow motion. And part of that was because it turned into a New St. Andrews puff piece. Let's promote New St. Andrews. And so everybody who's on staff at New St. Andrews, I don't remember if the janitor got interviewed, but it might have been. It would have fit. I mean, there's this one lady. She's standing in her garden, watering your lawn, talking to you about feminism. And I'm just like, you could have lost all of that and missed none of the point of the film at all. Or it could have all been done much easier than that. So, the one guy they showed there had some interesting comments about how easy it is to get into universities and things like that. some chuckles on that one, one of the guys on staff. But most of the stuff was just completely unnecessary. Didn't need to be there. Could have been done a lot faster than it was. Like I said, the profanity that was used by the protesters in Bloomington, I get it. You want to show them for what they really are. I don't know how in the world they got footage of these people putting makeup on themselves to make them look like they had been beaten up. But that was, I was like, wow, that's amazing. I get that part. But if I'm right, and if during that one scene where it's just Doug Wilson and there's this hip-hop rap thing in the background, and if I'm right and that whoever it was dropping profanity in that, why? Why? That wasn't protesters. That didn't get that. Anyway, so all in all, I felt it was very poorly put together. Tried to cover way too much ground. And I don't care. There was a nice long presentation on postmillennialism at the end and stuff. I'm not criticizing that. I mean, we could debate that. We could argue that. I've got my problems with some of the interpretation, but that didn't bother me. That's where they're coming from. Fine, whatever. Just simply looking at it and going, you know, what's this supposed to accomplish and what could it have accomplished? I'd give it a C-. C-. I'm not sure if that's a Rotten Tomato or how many stars or any rest of that kind of stuff. But I teach classes, and so I know that these days, and no matter where I teach, you give somebody a C anything, and they're ready to have you lynched. Vast majority of students today expect walking through the door to leave that class with an A. And once you get to an A- or a B+, now you're the terrible, horrible, mean, nasty dude. So it's interesting. So C- for free speech apocalypse. And it had nothing to do with the fact that while my car was parked in the parking lot during the film, some bozo couldn't lack the skills to pull out of the parking place next to me and about took my rear bumper off. So had nothing to do with. I did not know that that had happened until after I reviewed the film in my mind. So it didn't have anything to do with that. Even though if you are the one that did that, I just want you to know that someday God will get you for that. All right. Let's go to an audio thing now. And I saw a note on Facebook about an upcoming election in the Southern Baptist Convention, the Kentucky State Convention specifically. And the two primary people, one is a preaching professor from Southern, and one is not. And the fellow who is not is named Jerry Tooley. And evidently, Brother Tooley's primary qualification for being president of the Kentucky State Baptist is that he doesn't think that everything should be coming out of Louisville, Southern Seminaries specifically, and all this newfangled Calvinism. Newfangled Calvinists, that's his terminology, newfangled.
So he knows about the old-fangled stuff, too?
No, I don't get the feeling that Brother Tooley is real up on his church history.
So he's got his fangles all messed up.
It's a tangle of fangle, yes. Either that or he studied at the Emer Cantor School of Baptist History, one of the two. That's a possibility, too. There's some weird stuff going out there. You got Yarnell and the revisionists trying to get rid of all the Calvinists in Southern Baptist history. But so here's there's interesting comments in the channel right now that I won't. Yeah, his name is Adam Ford, so Adam 4D, not Adam 4D. Ford. Well, it's how it's spelled. If I said Adam Ford, you wouldn't be able to find him. It's Adam 4D is how you find it when you Google it and stuff like that, whatever. Anyway, I just want you to listen to, this is an announcement that I'm going to, not I, but that Brother Tooley is going to be running for the presidency, and this is, I don't know. It just sort of speaks for itself. You ready for this? All right, here we go.
I don't know if you know it or not. Back a few months ago, back in November of last year, I was elected first vice president of the Kentucky Baptist Convention. I've had some folks approach me, and I am running for the presidency of the Kentucky Baptist Convention this year. And the reason why I'm running, thank you. Is I feel like that there are, that somebody needs to stand up and say something for folks that are in the pew. And I don't think that that comes out of Louisville. I don't think that has to come through Southern Seminary, is what I'm saying to you. And I had a number of people approach me and asked me to run, and I am. Some have asked me, well, Brother Jerry, we want you to get it. We do want you to get it, but will you be leaving if you do? And no, of course, I won't be leaving. I'm still going to be here. We'll still be the director of missions here. We'll just be a little added run to Louisville and putting up with a whole lot of crazy stuff and that kind of thing. But I feel like it's important that we stand up for what's right. And I think that it's time that somebody had enough gumption and brass about them to stand up for what's right and what's true. And by George, when they asked me, I figured I was the guy. We believe in a whosoever will gospel, that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And that's what has made us as Baptists who we are. And that somebody needs to stand up and say, we're tired of this highfalutin new stuff that's coming around. It's time for somebody to stand up and try to change some things. And that's what we're going to try to do. Okay?
Highfalutin new stuff. The highfalutin new stuff. Now, the lowfalutin new stuff is okay. But the highfalutin new stuff that's what?
I qualify to run for this office because all the stuff that I'm against.
That's basically it.
Yep. I don't want no more of this highfalutin new stuff.
Highfalutin new stuff.
That's right out.
I didn't do the accent. You did.
But I can do it.
just because the camera's on you don't mean you can do that, because you get to handle all the complaints you're going to get from all of our brethren in Kentucky. So, yeah, there you go. I don't even know what to say about that, other than we can hope that the relative qualifications of the two brethren who are put forward for the office will be appropriately analyzed and dealt with. There's a little bit of anti-reformed sentiment out there somewhere. Did y'all see? I don't talk politics very much here. I mean, we touch on it when it's cultural and things like that. But I did make a comment on Facebook last night, because I saw a meme on Facebook and it did strike me, and it struck me because I think for a long time I have been pretty consistent in emphasizing the need for equal standards. And hence, I must confess, I am in constant agony these days when I contemplate the mainstream media in the United States of America. And this is true in all socializing cultures. And I think it's a good term. This is a socializing culture. We are moving into socialism. We fought it for a long time, but now the next generation doesn't even know what it is, knows nothing about our history, and has been convinced that all generations before ours were a bunch of privileged, evil, bigoted people anyways. So we have been defeated by our enemies because they took over the educational system. And in socializing cultures, the first thing they do is they take over the media. The media, which is supposed to do journalism, no longer even pretends to do journalism. Now, this past weekend, a story broke about Politico going after Ben Carson. Now, I mentioned on Facebook, Ben Carson is not my number one candidate. I am not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican. I'm neither one. I am independent because neither one of them are conservative enough for me. I mean, as if there is such thing as a conservative Democrat anymore anyways. And I rather straightforwardly on Facebook said I think they should change their name to the Socialist Party so they'd be more honest. And few Republicans, maybe to the Semi-Socialist Party, because they would be more honest too. But anyway, but this hit piece came out on Ben Carson about West Point. And this meme came up, and I reposted it, or whatever you do on Facebook, because it said so much. And it said, "Congratulations, Dr. Ben Carson, for being the first African-American candidate for the President of the United States whose background has been investigated by the mainstream media, by the press." And it's exactly right. It's exactly right. I mean, there's another meme out there. I didn't try looking for it. I could probably find it just by scrolling on my feed here. But there's another meme out here that has on the top, Ben Carson, and on the bottom, Barack Obama, and what? And it says, it talks about top SAT for Carson, top SAT score in Michigan, 20 honorary doctorates, and all the rest of this stuff. And then below it has Barack Obama. It says, record sealed. And that's true. That's true. I remember 2007 and 2008, and I remember all sorts of people going, yeah, there it is. Yeah, highest SAT score in Detroit, 20-year history, graduated honors and accepted to Yale, awarded 60 honorary doctorates. That's Carson. Then it's got a picture of Obama, records sealed. And the media is perfectly fine with that. And if you don't think that that's not an example of double standards, I don't even know what to say to you. And so I'm in agony because I'm looking at this, and it's just the constant reminder of the hypocrisy that it has become absolutely established in our society. And that is absolutely how we are going to be treated by this society as well. And you know, we saw it on CNN. We if you go in expecting these people to treat you fairly, you're going to be sorely disappointed. So go in expecting reality, and you might be able to make something good come out of it. But as I said on Facebook, you know, I'd love to talk with Dr. Carson about the investigative judgment. Really would. Someone said that I should read his book. Does he mention it in there? Could someone tell me? Could someone maybe tweet me or Facebook me or something to where there is a mention or an explanation in Dr. Carson's book about his theology and specifically the concept of investigative judgment? Because for me, that's the dividing line. That's the dividing line. If you accept and function on the basis of the concept of investigative judgment, I believe it's a false gospel. I really do. That's the dividing line. Are there Seventh-day Adventists that reject that? Yes, there are. I would be overjoyed if he was one of them. But then we'd have to start talking about when life begins, because I don't think he's quite right on that. He says about 7 weeks, and when the heart starts beating. That's his position. So, like I said, and I also said this. Of all the candidates, I do get the feeling that if the founders were looking at those candidates, and just on the basis of what they envisioned the presidency to be, Ben Carson would be exactly who they would think should be president. For one reason, they didn't envision this kind of political animal where you have to have come up through the ranks of politics. They wanted people who were citizen patriots, who would come to Washington, do the right thing, do what was best for America, and then leave. You know, I heard somebody, I forget who it was, talking about Harry Truman. Harry Truman. You know, Harry Truman was concerned when he left the White House as to whether he was going to be able to feed his family after he left the White House. Because unlike pretty much every president since then, Truman refused to use his position to enrich himself, to establish all those relationships that would, well, just look at certain people who are running for the office today who have already been grossly enriched by their political machinations, shall we say. That's the kind of person they're looking for. And I think on that level, Ben Carson would be exactly the type of person they would be looking for. So, but just the hypocrisy, the double standards, and what I said was, you know, I think he's too nice a guy to run for president. He is going to be scarred by this no matter what. No matter what. Whether he gets it or not, no matter what happens, the price that he and his family will have to pay. Man, it's awful. It's a big price. And it's not a price that should be exacted. That's what I'm saying. At least not in a nation that, well, anyway. I'm talking about a nation that doesn't exist anymore, to be perfectly honest with you. So we'll move on from there. I have said for a couple of weeks now that I wanted to address a particular question in the atheist debate, in the debate on atheism that took place, I don't even know what the date was, but it was, what, a month ago? And Cy and Jeff Durbin were on the Christian side. It was the pastor of the church that the Bonson Conference was held at. And even up until the day of the debate, all I could find online was versus atheists. It's just sort of generic, you know. We just sort of walked through a university mall and grabbed three people, and they had long hair, so it worked, you know, type thing. you know, once it was made available, I downloaded it, I listened to it on a ride, and it was a free-for-all, and it was meant to be a free-for-all. They kept reminding us that it's sort of meant to be this way, and people are supposed to be talking over each other, and stuff like that, and that kind of stuff. But what, you know, there's lots of stuff I could have said. I mean, the opening atheist guy, was it Doug or Gary? He was the one they caught on open mic, saying, never again, Cy. His opening statement was just this shotgun blast of disconnected, unsubstantiated, non-reflective, standard Dan Barker, Dennis McKenzie-style, surface-level, shallow blah. I mean, it was just, it was no worth to it at all. No worth to it at all. Your standard American atheist dribble. Shows no meaningful knowledge of the subject, though. Some of the other atheists were a little more reflective. But anyway, but of all that I heard, there was this one audience question that made me go, I mean, it would have been the Picard Riker double, facepalm. You know what I mean? So those of you in Facebook know exactly what you've seen the Picard Riker double facepalm. Okay. Some people have even photoshopped that and threw in a third Riker when it's real, a third Picard or a second Picard for when it's really, really bad. But the sad thing is, I know which episode that was from. That's the really sad part about the whole thing. It's like, I remember that. Never mind. So it's a Picard Riker double facepalm question thing here. And the question was an honest and good question. The response illustrated the fundamental ignorance even of this entire atheist panel. This entire atheist panel demonstrated a fundamental ignorance about the issue of intelligent design and what is evidence of intelligent design. And I think it'd be worthwhile for us to listen to it and then point out what the problems are, because you'll run into this all the time. And if you encounter an atheist that answers like these atheists did, then you know you're talking to someone who has never either been willing to or been had explained to them what the evidence of intelligent design actually is. Because their response here is completely out of bounds. Completely out of bounds. So let's hope I've got the right one here. Get the cursor all the way back across four screens. And here we go.
Yes, I'd like to ask a practical question, get a little away from some theology now. But I've always wanted to ask an atheist this question, but I never found one that it would admit that he was, and I'm glad that I finally got to do this.
I'm available online.
Thank you. At my age, I go to doctors quite a bit. And when I look in the doctor's office, I see what the human body looks like and where all the parts are placed. And it all works real fine, and every once in a while, some part doesn't work. That's why you go to the doctor, so you can get it fixed. Now, I'm kind of setting the table for a question, so please be patient with me. Now, when we had my wife deliver our first child, I went to the hospital and brought this little baby home. All the parts were in the right place. All the parts worked. And I thought to myself, who designed this? There has to be something out there. Now, you don't believe there's a God.
Straight to the question, please.
So let me ask you this. How is it that the human body is designed in such a way, in an absolute way, who designed it?
I'm afraid the question I can't make a lot of sense of, simply because I don't think that a designer is necessary. I also don't think a designer is necessary every time a beautiful snowflake is created. I don't think someone drew that and then gave the plans to the moisture in the air.
Now, let me stop it right there, because that's what caught me. Now, I want to address the rest of what the answer is given as well. That demonstrates that this man, I don't know what his name is, I'm sorry, couldn't keep track of who was what and so on and so forth. There aren't any graphics to tell you. But the middle atheist there has no earthly clue. If this is an honest response, okay, if he's playing games, maybe he does know and he's being purposely deceptive. I don't know. But if this is an honest response, then he has no earthly clue what intelligent design means, or even how to recognize intelligent design. Because notice the error that he just made. He talks about how a snowflake can be beautiful. Well, not that we see many of them around here in Arizona. South of Mogollon Rim. They had snow and Flagstaff just a few days ago. We don't get much snow. But I did. I lived in Minnesota and Pennsylvania. So I've seen a little snow. And snowflakes are beautiful. Snow is beautiful. Well, to a point. Just say interfamily text, any news? And the answer is no. Summer may be watching, and this actually may be delaying, because she may find the program so fascinating that even the baby is fascinated as well and is.
Watchword of the day, be anxious for nothing.
The problem is this. There are beautiful structures in nature, such as snowflakes, minerals, some crystalline forms, beautiful lattice work and just, you know, gorgeous, but they don't carry information. A snowflake, the design may be complex and beautiful, but it's not informational. Now, the DNA strand in the nucleus with the specific coding that produces millions of differing proteins and all of the incredibly complex structures of living cells and living bodies. Nanomachines that we cannot, with our greatest technology, reproduce to this day using all of the intelligent design that we can come up with, that DNA may not be nearly as pretty as a snowflake, but it carries information. Now, someone might say, well, you know, there's some information in a mineral lattice. Well, yeah, it'll tell you what the various molecules are made of and how they're arranged. But again, the point is the ability to communicate data. The very building plans of a complex structure, such as the human body, are not found in the random joining together of molecules in a crystal, or in the formation of water molecules in the air. That is completely random. It may be beautiful, but that's not the same thing as passing the test for communicating information. Now, for example, I was pointing to my phone here, and everything about this screams design. Everything about it. There is a screen that happens to radiate electromagnetic radiation within the visible realm of my eyeballs. Otherwise, it would always look like that. Even went on. Because it could put out radiation outside of the realm that I could see. But no. It puts out radiation, and you can see it too. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. And there are these buttons that I happen to be able to push with my fingers. And when I hold it up to my ear, the sound comes out to where I can hear it. And my voice goes in to where the other person can then hear. And the apps have buttons in them that I can utilize so as to obtain further information and perform certain tasks. And everybody looks at this and goes, this is designed to be able to accomplish a particular task. And man, we keep asking more and more and more and more of these little things every 6 months or so. And people are more than happy to provide us with that because they then charge us great large amounts of money. The design that is found in biochemistry has a purpose and a function. It communicates information, and it communicates that over multiple generations. Complex information and specific information. When you understand, for example, how enzymes work, and how they have to have a particular molecular form, and how they have to bind in a particular way, and if there's so much as one molecule in the wrong place, so many of the diseases we now have come to understand have incredibly minor causes. Minor in the sense of it's just one little thing out of place. That level of specificity is absolutely necessary. And so, I don't know if this gentleman understands that. I don't know if he understands what biochemistry has revealed to us that Darwin knew nothing about, had no clue about at all. But that the level of complexity and interaction and function, all of which goes far beyond anything that I'm holding in my hand, and no rational human being would ever say that this arose accidentally. None. None. But there they sit. And with the very minds and bodies that exhibit that clear, unequivocal, unquestionable evidence of absolute intelligent design, they will use their intelligence to say, I don't see a designer. Where is a designer? I don't see a designer anywhere. It's amazing. The only way to explain it, these are intelligent men. It's a spiritual issue. It's a spiritual issue. So when you hear somebody saying that and referring to snowflakes or crystals or things like that, they don't get it. They don't get it. They've completely and totally missed it. Missed it. They don't get it.
As you well know and alluded to, the human body does not work so well so sometimes. I shouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for modern medicine and science and logic and reason and all those things that I suppress God to use, apparently.
Yeah, you know, I would not want to have to answer for those words someday. I really wouldn't. The mockery, and again, okay, so he's had some medical procedures. So have I. I think he says he had his appendix out. So did I. That was in first grade. And he's going to say, you know, he's going to do the old vestigial organ thing. Actually, we've discovered that there's a number of functions that the appendix is helpful in. But he's going to go down that road. But the mockery of, well, you know, it was just science. It was logic. He probably knows that the vast majority of advances in medicine were done by people who believed that you could actually examine the human body and do so in a meaningful fashion because God created it. He probably knows that. But anyway,
those things we understand now. I was able to get my appendix taken out, which would have killed me otherwise, because that's a rather useless piece inside my body. And that's left over from just the way that nature has developed such beings.
Notice how they cannot avoid. He's sitting there saying, I don't see any need for a designer. And yet nature has developed such beings. They can't avoid it. I was a bio major in college. And even though I was a Christian college, didn't use Christian textbooks. And these secular textbooks promoting and explaining the theory of evolution could not do so in the English language without utilizing language of design. And even a couple times even stumble into admitting the beauty of what seems like design, but really isn't. Well, no, actually, it really is. It really is. It's great.
Designer that's necessary.
One addition to that is it's wonderful to go through.
Now, I got to admit, Cy looks like he completely checked out. At this point, did you see that? Beep, there. Yo, Cy, dude. I know it was hot up there, but I'm not sure what Jeff's doing. He looks like he's tweeting or doing something. I don't know. But Cy has left the building at this. Punch the clock. Left the building.
That is, it's wonderful to go through the biological textbooks and find out other species that are similar to us that have all the parts that we have, and then start going back even further, and some of them don't have some of the parts and other parts, and to see how our...
There are parts and other parts and many parts, and the fact that we all live in an oxygen nitrogen atmosphere with a certain amount of gravity and have to eat the same kind of food shouldn't be relevant to why we have similar parts. I don't know.
Evolution came to design where we're at right now. It's all in I lost my train of thoughts for a moment. It's all
the miracle of evolution.
Survival of the fittest. Those people who maybe had an extra part or didn't have a big enough part at that particular time in their environment.
I just love, you know, I've told the story before. I'll tell it very quickly. When I graduated from Grand Canyon College, I majored in biology and Bible, minored in Greek. And the first book I read after I graduated was Blind Watchmaker by Richard Dawkins. I wanted to read the best the other side had to say, had to provide. And I had since high school. All of my biology professors, my biology teacher in high school, my biology professors in college were all trying to convince me of the evolutionary theory. So from the time I was a sophomore in high school, I was being given college-level articles on natural selection and the whole nine yards. And so it is very clear to me that very few atheists do anything more than just repeat the mantras. Because the whole concept of natural selection, and no Christian that I know of that knows anything about this subject denies that natural selection takes place. Obviously, it does. Sai's listening. Actually, I wanted to call him on calling a snowflake beautiful, but knew I wouldn't get the chance. Sai, you just... I don't know what you were staring at, but it was well beyond the confines of the back wall of that room. That's just what that was like. Into eternity. Anyway, it wasn't meant as a criticism. It was just, you know, the other guys were talking, and yet for some reason, they're showing you. And, you know, like I said, it looked like Jeff was tweeting something. I don't know. But anyways, these guys don't really understand natural selection. Natural selection takes place. Everybody knows natural selection takes place. There's nothing that can be argued that if your genetic manifestation gives you an advantage in having more offspring than someone else's genetic manifestation, then you're going to end up with more offspring in the gene pool, and you're going to predominate over time, assuming that the environmental conditions remain stable, which very frequently they do not. But that reality, which allows life to adapt, which would be predicted by a creationist model, is made to become the very engine of change in the evolutionary model. And it's not a big enough engine to do that. It functions on a very small scale in regards to the genetic material available to work with. And it's just not a big enough engine to run this thing. It's really not. Okay, now I'm getting all the responses here. Let's see. Okay, so Summer says to you, Rich, yeah, you try not being anxious with a 7-pound baby kicking your ribs all day. Okay, so there's yours. Sai says, oh, I was definitely checking out. And then Jeff just popped in with, I wasn't tweeting. I was probably staring at my notes, wishing there was a debate protocol and actual rules. I might have been playing Angry Birds. You had something electronic in your hand. I know that. So there you go. So we've got Sai and Jeff are both listening. And I did not tell them that I was going to be doing this. So maybe word got around. I don't know. But there you go. And Summer's listening too as well. How you doing, honey? You're just holding that baby, telling that baby to stay calm until the dividing line is done. I know what you're doing. But here's the phone. I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting. That was Jeff. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Anyways. Yeah, book says I need to do the dividing line in the distraction-free zone. Nah, people love it. People love watching me do the... In fact, my whole Sunday school lesson Sunday was the squirrel lesson. Squirrel! it wasn't totally my fault either. I dared mention something about Roman Catholicism. All of a sudden, hey, I've got a... What about... And, you know, because I was telling folks we're going to do the church history thing again. And Jeff says he's always stalking me. So, yeah, that's true. And, hey, Jeff, Josh passed his brown belt in Krav, so be careful. I can send him after you now, okay? Just, you may do your thing, but he's got jiu-jitsu and all that other stuff down, too. So just, you're getting older, dude. I hate to tell you that. Seeing a little, you know, this kind of stuff. Just life. Anyway, what were we talking about? We were talking about atheists that understand natural selection. The engine's too small. In fact, it reminds me, I saw The Martian over the weekend because I'd read the book. And so I wanted to see, and they stuck pretty close. I mean, they had to take a bunch of stuff out. They had to, you know, the book was long. Only at the end did they decide to try to rev stuff up a little bit. I won't tell you how, but, and then they added some stuff at the end because the book ended rather abruptly. One of the problems they had was how to get a certain ship to a certain place, and they had what's called an ion engine. And one of the things they explained was, it's great for long distance, but it's too small to do something real fast, to make major changes. Exact parallel to natural selection. Evolution requires it to do a whole lot more than what it's actually designed to do, and that is to allow for living organisms to adapt to a changing environment, which is sort of like what God wanted them to do. But anyway, so they don't really get this stuff, and they're just repeating what they're being told by other folks.
And those survived, kept on going. So that is not anything to do with social Darwinism right now. That's just to do with the survival of the fittest, and that's part of it. Study it. It's a fascinating experience to find out why physically we are the way we are.
Why is it a fascinating experience? I mean, it's just random. There's nothing fascinating about it because there's no purpose. Anyway, there you go. I'm shutting that one down so you can drop that one out of the picture. I'm going to another thing here, and that'll be our last thing for the day. So there you go. I just found that book just said, give the sign of the Alexandrian cult when the spoilers are over. I guess I hadn't seen The Martian. I wasn't giving any spoilers. I was just saying that I wanted to see how they translated that to the screen. And it did a fairly decent job. I mean, the book was weird because I actually found myself sitting here listening for a long period of time. Because I did it through Audible. I'm just telling you right now, the guy that did it on Audible got a bunch of awards for how well he did it. And there were times, there's some profanity, but there were times I just laughed out loud. I mean, the guy really did a good job. And, of course, I'm a space guy. I mean, I remember my dad installing a sound system at church, and I was laying in the pews, because I was too little to do anything, reading Mike Mars. Did you read any of the Mike Mars? But you knew who he was. No. Okay. Mike Mars was, you know, space exploration, astronaut stuff, you know. And that was my big... Why'd you put Bart Ehrman up there already?
Because I thought that's where you were headed next. You know, one of these days, we're actually going to get a sidetrack that's going to actually put us back on track.
One of these days?
One of these days. Okay. Hey, you know, random whatever. Yeah.
They're just covering the waterfront, man. They're just covering the waterfront. That's all there is to it. Now, what I was saying was, if you do like Audible... You know, I've got an Audible account, and I've really enjoyed it. The Martian was really, really well done. And then, what are you doing that for? Another book I just finished that was slow at the start but worth pushing through was called Killing Rommel. Killing Rommel. It was about the LRDG, the Long Range Desert Group, the British group in North Africa in 1942-1943. And it's historical fiction like the Shara stuff, but based on facts, and ended up being really good. So a couple Audible recommendations for you if you do the Audible thing. Good stuff to do. All right, so... We've covered a movie review. We've covered the atheist question, a little Ben Carson thrown in there, a little Kentucky Baptist convention politics that you're going to get to answer all the questions about because you're the one that did the accent. You did. I didn't do it.
Hey, I come from somewhere you can have an accent like that.
No, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Prescott,
I do.
No, Prescott does
yeah.
not.
Yeah,
qual-
well,
no.
It's it. Look at how we pronounce the name of the town.
No. Sorry. Sorry. You have not been deep enough south to think that Prescott is even close to rating that. No, doesn't work. Okay, let's get back to what some of you wish that... Some of you sit out there and you have no sense of humor whatsoever. I've met so many Calvinists who I don't know that I'd want to know you in life. You're just dry, boring, and I had one guy, and I blocked him. I looked at my Twitter block list. I've got 282 people on my Twitter block list. Yeah, Rich changing camera views so he can also be artsy. Aha, yeah, yeah. That's exactly what you're trying to do there.
That's pretty sharp there, son.
Tim,
picked
Tim,
right up on that, didn't you?
Tim from somewhere is saying, seriously wondering what this DL will be called. And then Timothy asks, how come your books are not on Audible? Because I'm a nobody. That's why. I don't even know which one I'm on anymore. I'm a nobody. That's why. Your books have got to be pretty famous to end up on Audible. So, nobody. I mean, can you imagine the grief book on Audible? That wouldn't be good. And who would read them? Anyways, with all the Greek and Hebrew and all that kind of weird stuff. All right. We press on with Bart Ehrman and his comments in regards to the subject of the deity of Christ. We began this on the last program, and we will have 53 minutes to press on with this, cover a lot of ground. I think it's important. We're doing a mega dividing line today. Again, all if Summer doesn't like my review of Ehrman, she can stop it in a second.
You've totally thrown me off here. We're doing a show on Monday, no less, and it's twice as long.
Yep. Yep.
Oh.
Yep. You didn't know it was going to be a mega size one?
You didn't tell me that.
Oh, well, okay.
See, folks, this is evidence that, you know, you call me up and you ask me, when is this or what's he going to talk about today? And I find out just about 30 seconds before you do.
That's right.
So
that's right. I don't. No.
What can I say?
No, no. I mean, there's a couple other things that I was thinking about talking about that I've decided not to at this particular point in time. So, you know, when people ask me what's the topic of that, I normally say religious stuff. That gives me freedom to go with the flow. If I was charismatic, I'd say follow the leadings of the Spirit. But I'm not charismatic, so we won't go there. All right. Back to... Back to serious stuff. That was pretty good. That was artsy. That was artsy, Rich. There you go. That's very. That's sort of what the movie did seem like to me a little bit. Especially if you do that while he's talking and I'm talking at the same time, and then throw some static into it. We're good. We're on it. Why
hey,
do
you
we?
Just, you know, you did a false move there. I was about to follow the lead. You just pulled it away right out from underneath me.
Why do we review Bart Ehrman? I am amazed. I have to admit that is probably the first time I've ever seen him in a suit and tie. But Bart, that suit ain't looking so good. I mean, honestly, he does not look well in that shot right there. I mean, the suit, the jacket looks like it's about 40 pounds ago. And I've done the 40 pounds ago thing. I mean, I've gone from 254 pounds down to, I've picked up a couple pounds recently, so I'm about 174. So, yeah, that's 80 pounds. And so, yeah, I get it. But I'm sort of wondering if he's doing okay. Because this doesn't look real well there. I've had a number of other people comment, he doesn't look good. I hope nothing's wrong. I do not wish any ill upon Dr. Ehrman. I would pray for his repentance, actually. Well, repentance unto life, because I doubt that that's ever been his situation in the past. Anyway, this was the debate with the Dallas prof, Justin Bass, on the subject of the deity of Christ, and specifically whether Jesus believed himself to be divine. And we've already noted that Bart's primary approach here is going to be to limit not only the range of information that can be brought into the debate, but the method of interpretation that can be applied to it, to a naturalistic realm. So his idea is history is naturalistic. History cannot, you know, you can't write a history saying God did this and God did that. If you allowed for that, then you would never be able to do meaningful history. So you have to come up with some other reason, background, cause than God. Now, of course, someone like myself would never say you don't do history by just simply going, well, whatever happened, God made it happen, and go home. There's obviously a balance to be found somewhere in here, but Dr. Ehrman doesn't believe that there is a balance. Dr. Ehrman likes to say he's a historian and used that as the means of avoiding the many contradictions and errors that he makes on a theological level. This is something he's done for a long, long time. But he is addressing a specifically theological issue. Because history can't tell you what Jesus thought. And the whole idea of the deity of Christ is outside the realm of any naturalistic history in the first place. So why is he even bothering? Well, because he has a theological position. He just doesn't want to actually have to stand up and do the theology part. That's the problem. So we'll pick up where we last left off in listening to Bart's presentation. Here we go.
What sources that are close to the time in which the events took place? You want sources that are consistent with one another. You want sources that corroborate one another, that say basically the same thing, and yet they say the things without having collaborated with one another. If you're a historian, this is your wish list. Suppose you want to write a biography of Alexander the Great. You want a lot of sources that are near his time, that are basically consistent with one another, that agree in how they present Alexander the Great and what he said and what he did without having borrowed this information from each other. That's what you want as a historian. You want that for Alexander the Great, you want it for Julius Caesar, and you want it for Jesus. If you're approaching the New Testament as a historian, you have to bracket your personal theological beliefs. You have to approach it the way historians approach sources.
Okay, so once again, just briefly, not going to expand upon it. Every time we review Bart Ehrman, every time we review his debates, we've reviewed many of them. You know, when I hear people saying, you Christians, you just sweep everything that doesn't go your way under the rug. That's not what we do on the Dividing Line. That's not our way of doing things. We take on these folks directly, and we let them speak, as we are doing right now. But here it is, again, over and over again, same thing. That's not how historians do it. And he gets to define what the methodology needs to be. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the academy have so capitulated to the naturalistic worldview when it comes to how academics are done, that a lot of people on our side are really not in a position to put up much of a fight when it comes to the fact that from a Christian perspective, Jesus Christ is Lord of history. And the biblical teaching is that God is working out his purposes in history. Now, whatever else that means if you're going to be a consistent Christian, you can still be a historian, and you can still utilize the best methods of historical research, but you're going to have to think through the worldview issues, especially when it comes to issues of motivation and answering questions of why, which most historians cannot answer and do not try to answer, by the way, because it's, from their perspective, beyond their purview.
New Testament, we do have numerous sources. We've got four of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But these sources are problematic for historians. I'm not saying that they're problematic for believers. I'm not saying you shouldn't base your lives on the teachings of Jesus found in the New Testament. I'm saying if you want to know what Jesus really said and did, these sources are problematic. Let me explain why. If we're looking for those kinds of sources, what do we have in the New Testament?
Stop it there, not for any other reason than I was reminded just now of the fact that I learned after the last program that the man who asked the question of Bart Ehrman that I mentioned last time, and that is, what would you accept as proper confirmation that we have the original Gospel of Mark? Remember, it's interesting. People afterwards were immediately telling me, by the way, the person who asked that question was Justin Bass, the guy he's debating now, which I find fascinating. And the other thing was, did you notice what I did? I actually helped Bart out. I did. What Bart asked for was actually far more ridiculous than I even remembered it to be. I mean, what he asked for about, 10 copies of Mark written with him in like 10, I said what, like 6 months? I think it was 10 days. Signed by Mark. I mean, it was so outrageously ridiculous that in my mind, I could not imagine anyone of any scholarly level whatsoever who could actually put forward such an absurdity as that. And afterwards, people were sending me YouTube links to, there was a YouTube video that had Dan Wallace shortly after the debate talking about how he had demonstrated clearly that Bart Ehrman is a radical skeptic, and here's why, and he gave the exact things that Bart had demanded. And so there was a bunch of stuff that came through Twitter after the program that... point out that, and I wasn't purposely trying to help Bart out. It's just that, in the intervening couple of years, it just seems like, someone that intelligent just couldn't be that radical, I guess, and so it actually was as bad as everybody said. So then it was actually Justin Bass who asked that question. Which is interesting that then they would end up being the two that are debating in this context.
First, the dates of the Gospels. Justin, sounds like we agree pretty much that the Gospels are written decades after the life of Jesus.
Now, I will take Bart's lead here. how many decades? This is an area where, if you want an example, you go into seminary, and if you've never put a lot of thought into the dating of the Gospels, when were the Gospels written? You go into seminary, and you're sitting there, and most of the time, you can really tell that your professor has done a lot of work, really knows his stuff. I remember once, toward the end of my master's with Fuller, and a pretty well-known Old Testament professor, I'm taking the prophets class from him. He had written a commentary on Esther. Think about that for a second. How do you write a book that thick on Esther? We had some other students and I were sitting there before class, and we had a question about Hebrew. And this is Dr. Hubbard from Denver. I guess there's no reason not to mention his name. And we asked him about it. And cold, no preparation, no nothing. Just glance at the text, bing, 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 there's your answer. You recognize that these guys really know what they're talking about. They've been around. They've been doing this stuff for a while. Okay. And so when they tell you that from their perspective, they think X, Y, and Z about areas that you've never really done a lot of thinking on, it's pretty easy to see why, without really listening to other sides, other perspectives, you end up developing a consensus. But it's a consensus of capitulation. It's a consensus of, well, it's just what everybody's saying. It's not because everyone's really done a lot of serious in-depth work on it. And so when you talk about the dating of the Gospels, what's the basis for the late dating of the Gospels? Well, if you listen to Bart Ehrman's lectures, I didn't mean to freeze him in the middle of drinking his water, but if you listen to Bart Ehrman's lectures, he has certain theories about what the early church looked like. For example, one of the reasons he doesn't believe that 1st, 2nd Timothy or Titus are apostolic, that is written by Paul, is because the form of the church revealed therein is too advanced, given Ehrman's theory as to what the church was to look like at that time. Well, what if you don't accept Ehrman's theory about the evolution of the hierarchy of the Christian church? When you start really digging into the dating issue, there are all sorts of assumptions that have been made that are extremely challengeable, that push those dates farther and farther back. A number of people have made a very good argument that there are things said, especially in the Synoptic Gospels, especially in like the Olivet Discourse, that if those books were actually written after the destruction of Jerusalem, they don't make much sense. And they wouldn't have been written the way that they're written, because there seem to be things that are left unfulfilled. If you're writing after those events, why would you write the way that you did? But if you're writing prophetically, and especially if you see both near and far prophetic fulfillments in regards to judgment upon Israel, second coming of Christ, things like that, which gets into all the preterism stuff and all the rest of that stuff. If you think those things through, there's a lot of good reason to think that at least Mark and Matthew are pre-70. And there's a really good reason to think that Luke Acts is probably mid-50s. Why? There's a theory, it's a good theory, I think, that Luke Acts is a amicus brief. It is something that Luke submits to the Caesar as evidence of the fact that Christians are not the enemies of the Caesar, but that they are preaching a gospel that is centered upon who Jesus was. Here's what Jesus taught. His is a heavenly kingdom. We are teaching people to live lives that are just and righteous and to assist others and so on and so forth. If this was actually written, and notice how odd the ending of Acts is? Sort of like it's written right around that time, huh? Well, if Paul's arrested mid-50s, late-50s, this would be long before the fall of Jerusalem. It would make sense for it to be written at that time. It wouldn't make much sense to be written later than that. And so there are, but you never hear people talking about that. And when I talk to seminary graduates who just automatically buy late dating, oh, yeah, Matthew's 80s and Luke's 90s and John's 110 or whatever, you know. And I go, why? Have you thought about these things? Have you looked into this? Well, no, but my New Testament professor, she was just, that's what everybody says, isn't it? And so I would love to see a meaningful debate on the actual dating of the Gospels. I've not seen anything like that. Because if you really dug into it, you discover that so much of what has been accepted, even across the evangelical landscape, is just based upon presuppositions that not a lot of good reason to buy into those things. Now, was there a period of apostolic preaching? Of course there was. Am I saying that Mark was written, 20 days after the ascension of Jesus? No, of course not. There would be no reason to even think that. But personally, I think you can make a really strong argument for talking, well, we know that Paul's writings are late 40s, mid 50s. We can pretty much demonstrate that. And Ehrman even accepts that, at least for the books of Paul, what he accepts as being Pauline. He has a very minimized Pauline corpus, only 7 books. But when it comes to the Gospels, I think you can make a strong case. If you're going to put Mark first, late 40s. Matthew and Luke, I think, are pretty much concurrent and probably late 50s. John, some people have argued for a pre-70 John. I'm a little more comfortable with a later John. I think that would explain a lot of the differences. I think one of the reasons that you have some of the synoptic differences is because they're written so early that there are people that are still alive that they have to keep in mind that you can only say certain things in published works in light of the persecution that is currently taking place. John's far enough down the road that a lot of those issues aren't relevant anymore. So I don't have any problem putting John later, as he has traditionally been put. But some people have made an argument pre-70. Wow, there is a 10-minute discussion on the dating of the Gospels. Let's let Dr. Ehrman finish his drink and continue on.
I think the Gospels between 70 and 90 A.D. Justin is dating them between 60 and 90. Fine. Jesus died around the year 30. That means the Gospels were written 30 to 60 years later. They are our earliest sources. The first account of Jesus' words comes to us from a source written 30, 40, 50 years later. Well, who wrote these books? Weren't they eyewitnesses? The author.
Now, did you catch that? 30, 40, 50 years later. Now, again, this is very effective in the modern context. It's very effective because we are living in a day of instant video coverage of everything, because we're all running around with these things, you know. I mean, a couple years ago, the Japanese tsunami, I heard about it and saw it first because of Twitter. Saw the link from Twitter, then I turned the TV on. And they were behind what I had already seen online. Okay, so this is what we're used to. This is an absolutely unique period in human history on that level. Absolutely unique. Remember World War II? No, most of us don't. But you would be reading in the newspaper about battles that took place 2 weeks ago. That's just how it worked. Yeah, that's just how it worked. And so the idea of a 30, 40, 50 years, now I'm thinking more 15, 20, 30 years myself, but as meant to communicate to the modern secularist, oh yeah, can't trust any of that. And they'll actually, he and Justin will get into that later on in the discussion.
The New Testament Gospels do not claim to be eyewitnesses. They don't claim to be people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They are written anonymously. They are not written in Jesus' native language, Aramaic. They're written in another language, Greek. They were not written by lower class fishermen and other peasants. They were written by highly educated Greek-speaking people living 40, 50 years later who were living in other parts of the world.
That is his theory. But he states it as a fact. He doesn't try to substantiate it. He assumes that Peter could not write what he wrote because it's too high for Peter, even though Peter has an amanuensis. He ignores the reality that Paul is a highly educated individual, and yet he's writing material that comes from the very earliest strata of tradition of the Christian faith. He looks at Matthew and Mark, and Luke is obviously highly educated. There's no question of that. But why do you have to think that they're nowhere near? All the evidence of the use of patrimony, the place names, the knowledge of the geography of Palestine, Jerusalem, Judea, Galilee, all of it points to documents that are written by people who, at least at one point, even if they are not there now as they write, were at one point in those places and knew those places intimately. Otherwise, you have to do what he does, and that is accuse the authors of being disingenuous, of being dishonest, because they represent themselves as having been there and give clear evidence of their having been there. So here you have Bart Ehrman doing the, I'm the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor, you just listen to what I have to say. This is argumentum ad authoritum. Ugh. I am Bart Ehrman, listen to me roar. And most people just go, yes, sir, okay, all right. And I go, no, afraid not. You can make those arguments if you want, but you aren't substantiating them, and that makes me wonder why. Why does your demeanor become one of the, you know, when you don't have a good substantiation for your argument, yell louder. You've heard that one before? That's what you got here. That's what you got here. Very, very arguable assertions being made there. And yet they're central to his point.
Where did they get their information from? They don't tell us. Luke indicates that people have passed on this information from the time there were eyewitnesses, but what are his specific sources? He doesn't tell us. Mark doesn't tell us. Matthew doesn't tell us. John doesn't tell us. What scholars have long thought is that these stories have come down to the gospel writers by word of mouth. There weren't gospels floating around a year after Jesus died, or 2 years later, or 5.
Catch that, my Muslim friends. I completely agree that they are drawing from, now he's putting them someplace else, okay? So he's saying these are not individuals that have the direct connections that we would say Mark had to Peter, that Matthew had directly as a disciple, that Luke had with Paul, that John had as one of the disciples, or even if you take you can take the other theory that the Gospel of John is written by the beloved disciple who's not one of the 12, but one of the Jerusalem disciples. Doesn't really make any difference as far as the reliability of the information is concerned, to be perfectly honest with you. It really doesn't. But all those, he's thrown those out, and so now you've got people out there someplace who are highly educated Greek speakers who are now going on what somebody told, what somebody told, what somebody told. This is what he wants you to be thinking, is that, well, they're going on what they were told. Told by whom? Now, at one point, because I forget which debate was it? Was it the one on, I think it was the one, was it with Craig Evans? Off the top of my head, I'm thinking that Ehrman and Evans did an unbelievable program on Ehrman's book, Forged. That's just what I'm remembering. I'm remembering a point that I thought Evans made against Ehrman, listening to an unbelievable broadcast, northbound 35th Avenue toward the bridge just south of Pinnacle Peak. The old index kicking in. It was before sunrise. Yeah, okay. I think that's who it was. Anyway, this is a part of the Ehrman thing that he demands. Now, let me just... I hate when I click on that.
Show us that stories have been changed over the years. Let me...
Okay. That, I think that was in that debate where someone, and I thought it was Craig Evans, asked him if he had read... Thought I had it in here, actually. Thought I had kept it in here. Just to hold up for camera shots. But, yeah, I don't see it down there. If he had read Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, what? Yeah, Daryl Bach, that's right. Daryl Bach, that's who it was. Yeah, that's who it was. Who did I Craig Evans. No, it was Daryl Bach. It was Dallas guy. Daryl Bach, they're on Unbelievable, right? Good, okay. Yes, well, and Bach, I think, was the one who asked him, have you not read Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Richard Balcom's book? And he didn't show any familiarity with it. Now, interestingly enough, he's been criticized for that roundly. It had to have gotten back to him. Because at one point, I'm not sure we'll get into it, you know, reviewing this. It may pop up, I don't know. But, at one point, Ehrman almost, with the, oh, please, attitude. So, well, of course I have. Of course I have. Well, when Bach asked him, he didn't seem to have indicated it. But he doesn't take very seriously the idea that the eyewitnesses continued to exercise any meaningful influence in the maintenance, promulgation, purity of the oral preaching of the church prior to the writing of the canonical gospels. He just doesn't, he seems to dismiss that. Just the same way as someone sent me a picture, I think Algo sent me a picture, of him rolling his eyes one of the times I mentioned the persecution of the early church during our debate. And it was just sort of like, oh, really? You know, and it just strikes me as amazing that someone who does textual criticism would not recognize how vitally important the governmental attempt to destroy the religion producing these documents would be to a textual critic. I mean, that's just a given. There is an example of his tradition, his agnostic tradition, deeply influencing, and I would say corrupting, his work in that particular field. But we have gone far enough on that one.
Think about the discrepancies of our Gospels. And I should just say up front, this is what convinced me that my views about the Bible were wrong when I was in my 20s. When I was diligently studying the New Testament Gospels in the original Greek, I started finding discrepancies. I knew people had said that. I didn't believe it because it was just a bunch of liberals saying these things. So I didn't believe them. But then I started studying. I started realizing there are discrepancies.
Now, just a second. Just a second. Just one second. No. Don't. You don't need to facepalm yet. Look, I know that there, you know, I know his story. I've read his books. I know his quote-unquote testimony. You know, nominal Christian background, you know, Episcopalian type stuff, but quote-unquote converted as a teenager, goes to Moody, goes to Wheaton, finally goes to Princeton. This is happening at Princeton. It doesn't happen at Wheaton and Moody. Now, is it possible that someone could avoid seriously thinking through synoptic issues, seriously thinking through the basic challenges? You know, the thing that he mentions is Abiathar the high priest, Mark. That's a professor wrote on his paper, maybe Mark was just wrong. And that opened the floodgates. That's what allowed him to see the light. Is it possible that he could have just been so checked out during the course of Moody and Wheaton that he never did a synoptic study? Yeah. I suppose it's possible. Says a lot about the level of his study at those places. But yeah, I suppose it's possible. You know, I have to keep in mind that what we've been doing at PRBC for over nine years now. Now, it's not been nine consecutive years in the sense of I do a lot of traveling these days. But we are this close to finishing a 9-year study of the Synoptic Gospels. And I don't have it in here. At least I don't think I have it in here. But somewhere, probably, yeah, in the other... Oh, no, there it is. Right down there. I'm not sure if I'm too tethered to get to it. Yep, Synopsis Quattro Evangelium. There it is. Blue text right down. Get Ehrman out of the way. There you go. Right there. There is the Synopsis Quattro Evangelium. That's the Greek one, but we've been using the English one. Same thing. We have been studying the Synoptic Gospels from the start in the exact way that Bart Ehrman says it should be done. And that is in parallel. Not going through Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, then John, but going through in parallel and across. If you listen to him, you would think that most Christians never do that. And certainly no conservative Christians ever do that. Because if conservative Christians did that, then they would see all these discrepancies. Well, we have certainly seen all the discrepancies. And what's a discrepancy? Discrepancy is where Matthew, Mark, and Luke are not photocopies of each other. And who in the world would think that they should be? Well, evidently, Barter. And evidently, Yusuf Ismail. And all the Muslims who will constantly point to any difference in phraseology, chronology, or anything else between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And say, see, they should be photocopies of each other. Don't worry about when the Quran isn't a photocopy of itself, but that's a different issue. You'll be able to see how that works out, well, somewhat, once we get the videos, which we should be getting fairly soon, from the debates in Durban. Anyway, it is a naive approach to just simply throw out all the discrepancies. So I started seeing all these discrepancies. One of the reasons I've done what I've done at PRBC is to make sure that everyone who has been through that class, and of course, when you do it over a decade, obviously almost nobody has been through all of them. I can think of Rick Darrow and Jim Callahan and a few folks like that that have now been through pretty much all of it. But I want to make sure that the students in my class, when they go to university, when they run into people who look to this man as their leader, will be able to, with confidence, not with arrogance, but with confidence, respond to what the man has to say, respond to what they are taught in those classes. And I am very thankful that I can think of individuals who sat through that class, who at least sat through years of that class, went off to university, got in touch with me later on and said, guess what? You were right. That's exactly what I ran into. And it's exactly like you said. This is what they said. This is how they argued it. Wow, it's like you've been there. Yeah, just a little bit. And that's what I want. Would I suggest to teachers, pastors, and the listening audience that this might be a study you might want to consider? Well, you might not want to try to tackle the entire field, you know, from beginning to end, a lot of material. That's an entire gospel study. But, you know, pick out some of the key synoptic issues. Jairus' daughter, man, I've used that one a bunch of times, and mainly because Shabir Ali brought it up in the debate at Biola. We had just covered it in Sunday school. But there are, especially this coming spring, going into resurrection season. That's where we are right now, dealing with the Gospels as to those particular, and there are some tough issues there, but there are good, solid answers. And I know there's a fear on the part of a lot of ministers to overwhelm their people or to scare their people off. But you know what? We live in a day where these people predominate. They are the ones that have the media loves Bart Ehrman. They love John Dominic Crossan. They love the people that will give you a reason to not believe in Orthodox Christianity. And I just don't think we're doing our people any favors when we don't do the hard work of convincing them that they really need to be paying attention here. Let's knuckle down and do the work. And I understand you might be in a church where that would absolutely be like lighting a match in a room that's had a gas leak for the past 6 hours. Might be a bad thing. Okay, I get it. I understand. But your goal at least should be to move your people toward a level of maturity to where they'd be able to handle that kind of discussion. I really think something you might want to consider, might want to think about.
Once you realize it there, you start finding them, lots of them. There are important differences among our Gospels that cannot be reconciled with one another. You don't have to take my word for this. Simply read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John next to each other. The problem is when we read the New Testament, we tend to read all of Matthew. We go from the beginning to the end. It's about the life and death of Jesus. And all, great, it's the gospel, life and death of Jesus. Then you read Mark, and it sounds like Matthew, life and death of Jesus. Then you go to Luke, it sounds like Matthew and Mark, life and death of Jesus. And John, that's a little different, but it's basically the life and death of Jesus. And so it all sounds the same, because you're reading it from top to bottom. The way to see that these Gospels are different from each other is not to read them from top to bottom, it's to read them across each other. Read a story in Matthew, then the same story in Mark, the same story in Luke, and compare them in detail. Do it with the resurrection narratives. Just read for yourself the resurrection narratives and ask yourself, can you reconcile these Gospels? Who goes to the tomb? Okay, some women.
Okay, now, I remember 3 or 4 years ago, one of the things I did at Covenant of Grace Church in St. Charles, which I will be there again. This will be, we skipped a year. We missed a year. This will be the 15th year, but it wasn't 15 years in a row. I was in Ukraine last year. And they didn't mind that because Pastor Van goes to Ukraine. He goes to Donetsk. I go to Irpin, but we go to different places, but we both have a heart for the Ukrainian people. And Stay in mind that I wasn't able to be there last year, but we were going to try to work something out later on. It just didn't work out. But I will be in St. Charles first weekend in December, and I'm going to be doing something I actually haven't done before. The whole seminar will be on homosexuality. I really haven't done that. I've done debates. I've done single things, but the whole weekend? No. Well, when I say weekend, I doubt I'll be preaching on that on Sunday, but who knows? So I've got all sorts of keynote to develop, and it'll be good. It'll be good. So if you're around the conference, I've sent the stuff to Micah, so hopefully we'll have a banner ad up here pretty soon. And we'll be doing homosexuality there. But about 3 years ago, there at St. Charles, and then I think I repeated it, so it may have been a little more than that. I repeated it at one of the street preaching conventions that I went to, Jeremiah Cry, I think, in New York, the one in New York. I did the same presentation where I went through, and we've done this before, we go through this is an Urbanism. It depends on which gospel you read. It depends on which gospel you read. It depends on which gospel you read. It is a surface level. I think it's a highly offensive because he knows that there are answers to every single one of these alleged discrepancies. He knows it, but he never mentions it. Never mentions it. I think it's dishonest. It is a mechanism, and I'm calling him on it. But we've gone through these. And we've walked through them point by point by point by point. Here's where he says this, but here's the reality. You know, he likes to throw John over against the synoptics as the day of the Passover. We go through the day of the Passover. Da, 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 da. It's so easy to do this. It is so easy to do this. I run into this in debates all the time. Muslims do this all the time. It's so easy. And Christians do it in response to Muslims. I mean, you really don't think that I could very easily put together an entire list of alleged contradictions in the Quran and just shoot them all out there? And to explain anyone requires looking at context, background, being honest with it, and that takes a whole lot more time to answer it than it does to make the accusation. And so you just throw a bunch of stuff out here. And I've heard him do this over and over and over again. He doesn't even need his notes at this point because he's done this for years. But it's not meaningful argumentation. And he knows it. And that bothers me. Really bothers me a lot.
Or several women. If it's several women, what are their names? It depends which gospel you read. What do they see there?
It depends which gospel you read. In other words, some gospels give more data than others. Some are very brief and do not give sufficient data to answer the questions. Others give more information and sufficient information to answer more of the questions. And some are in between. And who are you, Bart Ehrman, to judge the motivations of Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Do you know all the situations they were in? Do you know everyone that they knew? Do you know who was still alive when they were writing? Might there be a reason why one person writing in one area would write something where he protects someone's identity and someone writing someplace else doesn't need to do that? Have you thought about any of those things? No. You just throw the stuff out there and destroy the faith of people and maybe just hope that they will never find out later on that there were actually meaningful answers. How do you do that? I don't get it. I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror in the morning, so I can't argue that way. I can argue that way against all sorts of positions. There are lots of arguments that would make me, quote-unquote, more popular. But I can't use them. That consistency thing again.
Do they see a man there, or two men there, or do they see an angel there? Depends which gospel you read. Was the stone already rolled?
So are those contradictory things? Are you really seriously saying that seeing a man or seeing an angel. Are you, what, you think that angels have wings, and so they, you know, well, a man wouldn't have wings. You really think that these books being written, this is one of the reasons they have to put in so late, but what if they were being written in the same time period where the eyewitnesses are still alive? You don't think that, what makes these contradictory, in other words? Do you really think that saying man is meant to be differentiated from angel? Man, not angel? Because he's a messenger delivering a supernatural message. So he, what, was he someone from some other city? Yeah, you got to have the halo, yeah. And then one or two? Again, anybody who for a second takes seriously the analysis of differing accounts of any historical event knows that some people will emphasize the one person who spoke, will not mention other people that were with him. Other people will mention the specific number. Other will just simply talk about a crowd. If there is one, then if there were two, then there had to be at least one, right? Again, the assumption is these are all contradictions. They don't have to be, unless you're functioning on the guilty until proven innocent basis, which is generally how Barterman argues, and the people, again, who then follow him. Because remember, Barterman's one man, but he needs to recognize, and I've pointed out to him, he wasn't happy about it, but I point out to him, there are a lot of people who follow after him and utilize his argumentation, and maybe not even as carefully as he makes it, but they're there. And when he plays with his conclusions, when he doesn't act fairly and consistently in his argumentation, that only becomes magnified each time it goes down the road until you end up with the wacko people that my daughter ran into in college, who clearly start with him and then go off into pretty wild and crazy and zany stuff after that. So we'll stop it there. We've put you through 2 hours of rambling. And oh, I remembered his name. I just didn't want to necessarily give him any airtime. Rambling discussions on all sorts of things. Hopefully something along those lines. Dating of the Gospels and movie reviews and everything else was of some assistance to you, some help to you, even when we started chasing after squirrels and things like that. It was a transition. It was purposeful. We had planned that. That was, remember in the
It was very much on purpose.
In the pre-show meeting where we get together,
yeah,
we go through over
that.
Minute by minute, you know.
I want to remind folks, let's keep summer in prayer.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
We're on Baby Watch. And...
yep. And when will we be doing the Dividing Line again?
I don't know.
We might do a program tomorrow. It's really up to just two people.
I might announce something, and I might not announce something.
And he may announce something and then cancel something.
Could be that, too.
We'll see. We'll see. We just figured we'd sort of front-load the week just in case. All right? So, anyways, thanks for listening to The Dividing Line, and we might see you tomorrow. Keep an eye on Facebook, Twitter, the website, wherever. That's how you'll find out. We'll see you sometime. God bless.